So what do you do when the person who was your safe place is suddenly gone? Today, we're talking about grief, surviving unimaginable loss. Now, sometimes the hardest chapter in your life becomes the beginning of finding yourself again. So welcome back to the show, everyone. Today's conversation is one of the most personal episodes we've ever done. Our guest today is Sammy DeMarco. She is a certified life coach, mental health advocate, and the author of an upcoming memoir that shares her powerful journey through childhood trauma, ADHD, narcissistic abuse, grief healing, and ultimately finding joy again. In our last episodes, Sammy shared how anxiety, undiagnosed ADHD, and an emotionally abusive marriage slowly caused her to lose herself. If you have not listened to those episodes, please go back and do so and come back to this one so you can hear more of her story. But today we're talking about the moment that changed everything for her. And that is the loss of her mom. Her mom wasn't just her mother. She was her best friend, her biggest supporter, and the person who made Sammy feel safest in the world. So we're going to be talking about navigating devastating grief while living in an unhealthy marriage, why losing one person made it so difficult to leave another, and how something as unexpected as 90s music and the Backstreet Boys became part of her healing journey. Sammy, welcome back to the show. I'm super excited that you're here. This is going to be a really powerful and probably emotional conversation, but it's where everything shifted for you. So thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. And it definitely is going to be one of those in my feels kind of conversations for sure. Because like you said, this was the moment in my life that kind of split time in two for me, to where there was a life and a Sammy that existed when my mom was alive, and there's a whole new person and a whole new life that exists after losing her. So it really was a defining moment in my life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, losing a parent is hard, never mind in the midst of all of the chaos that you were going through in that time. So I would love, before we talk about losing your mom, I'd love everyone to meet her through your eyes. So who was she and what made her so special?
My mom was literally the best. And that's how everybody described her. Like, she was the best mom, the best friend, the best sister, the best aunt, like the best anybody could have. She was so filled with joy and laughter. And she was one of those persons where, like, her laughter was so contagious. And she really taught us growing up that the most important things are keeping our family together and being able to have fun in doing that. So she's like the mom that would start snowball fights with the neighbors next door with us. There is one year that she sprayed the whole backyard with water during the winter and made us an ice skating rink, and was like out there every day in the cold spraying the water so we could have ice skating rinks. And even when we got older, she still wanted things to be fun. There was a time that she was unemployed for 6 months, and she just got this great idea that she was going to start family theme night. And every Wednesday, she would pick a theme for dinner, and you would have to dress up for that theme, and she would decorate for that theme, and she would make food for that theme. So, like, if she was making tacos, it was going to be a fiesta night, and we all had to dress in our fiesta clothes, and she would have all the decorations up. And that is something that became a staple in our family through adulthood. When we each had birthdays, my mom would create a theme party for us, and you wouldn't know what your theme was until you got to the party, but everybody else knew. It was kind of like the surprise was your theme. But she was just so much fun, and she was always there. You know, like, you remember the parent that always shows up, you know, and even if they don't show up perfectly, they show up every single time and know. They let you know that that's your safe space. That's, you know, exactly where you need to run to. And she just had this uncanny ability to know each one of her kids individually and to be able to relate to us based on who we were and not just a parent. And this is the way I parent. She parented us very differently based on the needs that we have.
She sounds amazing and like so much fun. So many amazing memories. Thank you so much for sharing that. So your mom was ultimately diagnosed with liver disease. And what was that like for you, and how did that change your world?
That was extremely scary. My mom first got sick a couple of days after my wedding. We noticed at my wedding that her stomach was very distended, and we were asking questions and everything, like what's going on. And she just vaguely was like, my liver numbers are off. I'm taking medication from the doctor. It's no big deal. But it was a much bigger deal than we thought it was. 2 days after the wedding, she was admitted to the hospital. She had 14 liters of fluid drained from her abdomen. Just insanity. And then from there on, she's progressively started to get a little bit worse, where she would have these episodes of what's called hepatic encephalopathy, where she wouldn't know where she was. She wouldn't know like what she was doing. She'd become aggressive. She'd become extremely sleepy. And it's very dangerous when that happens. Like, you need to get them to the hospital and get them on IVs like right away. And those were the moments that were the scariest at first, because I had never seen my mom sick in my life. And the first time she had an episode like that was actually on my birthday, when we were supposed to go out to dinner. When I got to her house, she was just refusing to get out of bed, which was not like her. She'd at least tell us, like, I'm not feeling well, I have to cancel. But she just kept saying, I'm tired, leave me alone. Like, and we're like, this is not like her. What's going on? Called her doctors and they told us what's going on. And so we had to get her over to the hospital. And there were times we've had to do this several times, where you call the EMTs. And because she could answer some of the questions, they couldn't take her against her will at first. But if we called a second time, they would be able to. So we would have to call the EMT, let them come, let them leave, and then call them right back. And then have my mom removed from the house and taken to the hospital, like, against her will. But she didn't know, like, what was going on or anything like that. And to see a woman who was so incredibly strong your whole life, who also experienced a ton of trauma and overcame it and kept that attitude, to just be suddenly so weak and unable to help herself was unbelievably scary. And as the oldest, I was her medical power of attorney. So I had to make all of the decisions and, you know, take care of her health care. And that's how we found out she needed a liver transplant. Not because she told us. I think that partially she was in denial about it. And I think partially she didn't want to burden us, basically, because she knew exactly what we would do with the minute we found out that she needed a transplant, which is what all of us kids did. We went and got tested to see if we could be donors so we could help her out.
It's really interesting to see, and the contrast, right? Like, here's this person that is essentially like a superhero to you, and all of a sudden they're unable to look after themselves and you're having to step in. That must have been really challenging to switch your mindset and be like, oh my gosh, now we need to take care of mom. When the transplant, when it came to, you know, having the transplant, did you feel like that would have given you a second chance together? And what was it like watching someone you love essentially fight for their life?
Yeah, it was horrible. Yeah. Before my mom even had the transplant, she was scheduled to have it at the end of January, and she ended up contracting the H1N1 strain of the flu, which was the swine flu. She ended up in ICU on a ventilator, and basically the doctor's telling us, we're not sure, you know, if she's going to make it. She is one of the sickest people that we have in the hospital right now. And so we hadn't even gotten to the transplant, and we had already, like, been on the cusp of losing our mom. And thankfully, she fought through that. And, you know, she was able to recover. And then eventually my brother was her liver donor. So she went to have the transplant, and my brother being her donor. And our hope was that this would be the second chance for her, that we would get, you know, a bunch more time, that she would have like the rest of her life with us, you know. But we also understood that her health at the time was so fragile, that my brother was going into that surgery and giving up half his liver, knowing full well my mom might not make it off the table. So right. It was like serious, where it was like, we're going to try this, we're going to do this, but there's no guarantee, you know? And so my brother is my hero for that, because he gave up a piece of himself, not even knowing for sure that this was going to work, but just the chance that it could work. was all he needed to just say, I'm going to do this. I want you girls to take care of mom, you know, afterwards. And going through that day of surgery was terrifying. I mean, you're sitting at the hospital for hours and hours and hours, and you are just like on edge waiting to hear a call. And like the longer it goes, you think it's going well. You don't want to hear a call too soon that something went wrong. An absolutely terrifying experience, to be honest with you.
Absolutely. And so tell us what happened.
So she ended up, she made it through the transplant, and it was a touch and go, like for a good week and a half there. She had to go back in surgery a couple of times. She had some hematomas. So we were on the edge of our seats, like most of the time, not really knowing what's going to happen. Thankfully, the hospital had these apartment complexes that were next to them that they allowed family members to like rent out for like $25 a night or something in order to stay there and be close by when you have someone who is terminally ill. So my sister and I were able to stay up by the hospital for that week following, you know, her transplant until she was out of the ICU and like out of immediate danger. But she ended up being hospitalized a total of 3 months fighting to recover from that. And it was a lot of them trying to get her anti-rejection medications right, but just so much back and forth with me running to the hospital, running home, running to the hospital, running home. And my mom, as determined as she was, she had a list of things that she was fighting for to get out of the hospital and things she wanted to do and see. So like she wanted to be a grandmother. And every time like all of us kids came into the hospital, she's like, just so you know, when I get out of here, somebody needs to give me a grandbaby. And she would take a family vacation to the Jersey Shore together, all of us. She wanted to buy a two-family house with my sister and dance with my brother at his wedding. And like that was what motivated her to really go forward, to the point where when she was in the hospital, she put a deposit on the house down the shore so that we could, you know, have that family vacation ready to go. And little by little, she started getting better. And she was able, my brother ended up having a baby with his wife, and she was able to meet her grandson, which was incredible. We took our family vacation, which was, I won't remember it for the rest of my life. Like, it was just the best family vacation, celebrating that she was doing well, that she was here, you know, celebrating my brother. It was just such a beautiful week. She got to buy a house with my sister, a two-family house with my sister. And then my brother's wedding came up, and her and my brother got to dance together at his wedding. And I mean, not a dry eye in the room, like just watching them standing there dancing together. Like everyone in that room knew what that moment meant and how much that meant for her. And I did too. Like I remember feeling so much joy and so grateful, but I also had this underlying bad feeling that something was going to happen. I kept having this feeling at my brother's wedding that I need to take everything in, that I needed to really like enjoy this because it would be the last time our whole family was together. And I remember talking to my ex and saying to him, like, I don't know if this is my anxiety or my intuition of just knowing that like my mom's health is still struggling, but I feel like I'm going to lose her so much sooner than, you know, we had ever planned. And we had a conversation about how like that would be awful. But at the same time, she was able to do all of it in her year and a half of life. So what mattered was the quality of life that she ended up getting afterwards versus the quantity of time that we had. You know, we wanted her to be around for as long as possible. But right after my brother's wedding, I felt like I was trying to come to grips with the fact that she had done all of her stuff and she had really like had all her dreams come true. And I just had this feeling that she was struggling and suffering a lot more than any of us ever realized. And that feeling turned out to be true. It turned out to be intuition and not anxiety.
That's, I mean, That's, first of all, amazing that you're able to tap into that, and amazing that she got to fulfill all of those things on her bucket list. You know, so many people don't get that opportunity. So that must have been such a magical time for you all. And it gives you perspective on life as well. And I want you to tell us what happened after that. But I want you to quickly just back up and let us know how you were doing in your marriage, because this was a huge issue. I think you mentioned in your marriage, because you were recently married to this guy who wanted your full attention. And so you're having, you know, your mom is sick and now you've got this man in your life and he's not really supporting this. Can you just back up a little bit and tell us how you are doing in all of this?
Yeah, it was very difficult because he would make this comment where he would say, "I don't resent your mom for being sick. I resent the situation because our lives are on hold right now." And I remember constantly thinking, like, whose life is on hold right now? Like, my life is still very much going and it's a nightmare. You know, like, life doesn't get put on hold. But what he was saying is, "I don't want all of your attention away from me. Like, my attention is on hold right now. Your attention towards me is on hold right now." And it was very difficult because at the hospital, he was very supportive. The times that he was there, you know, he was holding me, holding my hand, you know, being supportive. But I remember I had told you that I spent a week up at the hospital after my mom's surgery, and he had to go home because he, you know, had to work and everything like that. And I remember when I was finally coming home from the hospital that I called him and I was like, "Hey, I'm on my way home. Like, listen, I need to fall apart when I come home. I just need to fall. I have been holding it together for a week for everybody. And I just need you to be there for me and let me fall apart." And he was like, "Okay, no problem." I was like, "Can you just make sure your video games are off by then?" He's like, yeah, no problem. My mom sent food. Like, it'll be ready, whatever. Okay. I walk in the door and he's playing video games, of course. And I look at the food his mom sent. It has to be put in the oven. It's not like remotely ready. So I'm like, "Okay, I'm going to put the food in the oven. And then hopefully he'll turn this off when, you know, I am done doing that." I remember I sat down, he's still playing. I was like, "Can you turn this off?" And he was like, "In a minute, let me finish this game." And I'm like, "Do you understand how badly, like, I need you right now? Like, this game is not a priority." He's like, "The squad needs me right now. Like, the people that he was playing this game with needed him right now. But, like, no, your wife is right in front of you and needs you." And we started arguing about him telling me I'm nagging him and why does everything have to be my way. And I remember the timer went off for, there was, like, baked ziti in the oven. So I went to get it out of the oven. And when I pulled it out of the oven, it slipped from my hands, fell all over the floor. And when the ziti crashed to the floor, so did I. Like, that was just, I was done. I couldn't hold it together anymore. Broke down, like, crying. My ex came running and I thought he was coming to comfort me. And he came running and he instantly starts yelling about the ziti. "How could I drop it? His mom spent all this time preparing it for us. I'm just sitting here crying." And literally he said, like, "Just go to our room and cry and, like, deal with it while I clean up your mess." And it was like almost a reminder of childhood, of, like, being sent away when you are crying and hurting and emotional to go deal with it by yourself, because that's an inconvenience.
Right. And like, get yourself together and come back when you feel better.
Yeah. And it became a constant theme in our relationship, with my mom being sick, that anytime I had fears or, "How long are you going to be, you know, scared of this? How long are you going to be sad about this? How long are you going to this about that?" It was like, there's a timeline for when I was supposed to heal and adjust and deal with all of that. And my mom even noticed that things were getting rocky between us, because she was in the hospital. We went to visit one time and my mom, when we were leaving, said to him, "You'd be nice to her." And he just said to me, he's like, "Why would you say that? Like, she probably notices things. Like, obviously, I'm not telling her anything. I'm not talking to her about what's going on with us when she's sick in the hospital and like fighting for her life. Normally I would, but now I'm not because she has her own stuff to deal with. But she saw what was going on. And her friend saw it too, because when we went on the family vacation together, my mom's best friend was there and she pulled me aside and she's like, "Why are you putting up with that crap? Like, he is not a good guy for you. Like, he is treating you like shit. And like, are you even happy?" And I was like, "You know, I don't know. I don't know what I want to do. Like, no, but I think things can get better." I always made excuses for him, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was a lot going on emotionally. So you were probably just, you needed clarity.
And I was painfully aware, like, the day that like ZD incident happened, I remember so clearly because I remember thinking, "Oh my God, if I lose my mom, there's nobody else in this world that would possibly love me the way that she did," because I was learning that the person I married did not have that capacity in him to love me. And I was realizing I didn't know the person that I married. And so I remember, while fearing her loss, also that fear of like, I'm going to be all alone in the world if I lose her.
Right. Yeah, that's a big sign. So all of that is happening. And then your mom, can you tell us what happened next that no one expected?
So she seemed to be doing really well. And then 2.5 weeks after my brother's wedding, we went to her house. She was laying in bed and she was saying her stomach hurt. And I asked her, like, "Can we please take me to the hospital?" And she said, "I don't think I need to go to the hospital. I think I had food poisoning and I was throwing up last night. So now my stomach just feels like I did 1,000 sit-ups." And I was like, "I still think you should go to the hospital." She's like, "No, I'll call my doctor tomorrow." And then 2 days later, she was out with her best friend and her heart rate went up. She was tachycardic at that point. Her friend was like, "I'm calling 911 right now and we're taking you to the hospital." So she ended up going to the nearest hospital because of originally a cardiac issue. And it turned out that what happened was that her appendix had burst. And by she got to the hospital, she was already septic. And the crazy thing about that for me is I realized that she must have been walking around in so much more pain than she ever let anyone realize. Because if your appendix bursts and you feel like you just did 1,000 sit-ups, like, people go to the hospital when their appendix bursts. They're like, it's that painful, you know? So the fact that like, she wasn't in that like high pain threshold where she felt it was an emergency, to me was like, she must be in pain a lot and be used to the pain.
Right.
She went to the hospital and, you know, they let us know they had to put her on antibiotics for 2 days first. And then on a Friday, they scheduled her for the appendectomy. And I was there all day. She got out of surgery. Everything, you know, seemed like it went well. They told us it went well, that there was a small bleed, that they might have to go back in and like stent something or cauterize something. But I remember she came out of surgery and she asked me, "What time is it?" And I was like, "It's 6:00. And she's like, "I'm sorry you had to spend your whole day here." And I'm like, "Mom, don't apologize for the fact that I had to stay here all day." And at that point, my aunt was there. So my mom told me, she's like, "Go home and get some sleep. No, Aunt Donna's here. It's fine." And I'm like, "All right, I love you." She's like, "I love you." And I go home. The next day, I'm on my way to my sister's house to pick her up to head to the hospital. And I get a phone call from the doctor. And the doctor's asking us to come in and speak to him. And at that point, like, the panic set in me. I was driving and I started freaking out and I literally said to him, "Is she alive? Like, did she pass? Like, you need to tell me right now if she had passed away. Like, what is going on?" And he's like, "She is alive, but she's in very, very critical condition and I need you guys to come down here and to talk." And so we went down there and he told us about her condition. He said that there was a nick in her artery during the surgery that he swore any other surgeon would have not been able to avoid, which I think was a lot of excuses that he was making, but that there was a bleed during surgery. They fixed it, but she's not recovering from it. And at that point, she was on, you know, full pressors, on breathing machines, like on everything. And it became a really touch and go situation where all day Saturday, you know, we could visit her two at a time. And then I remember Saturday evening before we were getting ready to go home and get some rest, my brother and my dad were going to stay at the hospital. Since I was the medical power of attorney, they called me upstairs and they asked me if I wanted to sign a DNR, a do not resuscitate. And I just kind of collapsed like in that moment when they asked me that, because I knew how serious that meant, you know, when they're saying, do you want to sign something? And I couldn't make that decision at that point. I was like, I don't know. Like, if you can try, you might as well try, you know, like, but I didn't understand at the time what resuscitation does to your body and everything. Like, they were basically telling me, like, if she goes into cardiac arrest, which is a very likely scenario, that the resuscitation process alone is very tough on the body. And there's going to be very long time of, you know, recovery and everything. So we went home barely sleeping, waiting for the phone to ring to tell us, you know, that she had passed or something. And when we got to the hospital in the morning, it seemed more hopeful. They were like, we're going to try dialysis. We're going to try and see if we can get her stable enough to get her moved to the hospital that she had the transplant at. Because at the time, they had to take her to the closest hospital. But as the day went on and things were getting worse, they basically told us, like, her chance of survival at this point is about 5%. And I remember very clearly my mom always telling me, like, I do not want to live on life support. I don't want to live on tubes. Like, don't ever make me live that way. And so we had to make the decision to remove her from life support, which was the hardest decision that we've ever had to make. I give my dad a lot of credit for stepping up in that moment for me, because technically, I was the person that was supposed to sign the paperwork to allow them to take her off of life support. And my father's like, there's no way I'm going to let my daughter sign her name onto these papers that are essentially going to end her mother's life. Like, you need to let me do it. So ultimately, what they let me do was I had to give verbal authorization still to three different people, giving permission for them to remove the life support and for my father to sign for all that. And I did that, and we went up two by two. And I remember standing there crying, telling my mom how much I loved her, telling her I was going to be so strong for her that I would make her proud. And I remember my ex telling her, like, I promise I'm going to take such good care of your daughter. And, like, I think now I'm like, wow, that was the last lie he ever told her.
Wow.
You know? And then my dad. What an
incredibly challenging story.
Yep. And then my dad was the last to go up, and we decided that he would sit with her while she passed. We didn't think that that extra trauma of watching it happen would be good for us. And quite honestly, like, as much as my dad cheated on my mom and, like, was emotionally abusive, my mom still always said, like, your dad was the love of my life. You know, like, I still always loved him. He broke my heart. He's still my friend. Like, he's still one of my best friends. So I feel like it was right that he was able to be there with. But I'll never remember it. This was during COVID time, so we had to wait outside the hospital when it wasn't our turn to be in there. And I remember when he came out and he just was somber, and he looked up and he said, she's gone. And I will never forget the sounds that came out of me and my siblings. Like, this was not a cry. This was like, you just heard instant, like, wailing. And I mean, I, like, collapsed to the floor. We each had, like, our significant others trying to hold us up and everything like that. And the worst day of my whole life by far, because then we're like, now what? What do we do? We just leave her here at the hospital, you know, like, we just go home without her. Like, this is so wrong, you know?
It oh my gosh.
September 13th of 2020. And that will forever be the day that changed my life.
Well, first of all, thank you for sharing all of that. And I know how difficult it is for you to be sharing all of this, but I would love for you to kind of go more into how losing your mom, you know, changed you as a person, because that, like you said, was a pivotal moment for you. Tell us more about that?
So for me as a person, like I at first became extremely depressed for so long, you know, where I struggled to move myself out of that, being in a place where I had hope for anything. Like I stopped thinking about having kids and having a family. That was something that like I wanted to do and like have my mom there, who was like, you know, the grandma and all that. And suddenly I'm trying to picture life without her and I can't. And at the same time, I'm dealing with my ex who's trying to rush my grief and everything. And why are you crying every day and things like that. And I started to think I want to live my life in a way that honors my mom's legacy. Like my goal in life is just for people to be able to know who she was through her children, to get a piece of who my mom was. And with that, I remember a specific time in my relationship where things had gotten really bad, and it was 2 years before I officially left. But I remember sitting down with my ex and telling him, like, we're fighting all the time because we are dependent on each other for happiness and for like security. I need to figure out who I am. I need to work on myself. I need to work on my healing. You need to do the same, because unless we're both two healed, healthy people, we'll never have a healthy relationship. And so I did that. He did not, but I started that. And I started to shift my perspective, because what actually came up was a Backstreet Boys concert. So I remember having tickets to a show. And we had gotten the ticket, my friend and I had gotten the tickets before my mom had passed away or anything like that. And the show was coming up and I kind of felt bad. Like, how could I be going to this concert and having fun when my favorite person is not here right now? Like, it just doesn't seem right. And my friend and I talked about how, like, but your mom wouldn't want you to be miserable. Like, she would want you to, you know, things and have fun. And I'm like, I know that, but it's hard to comprehend. But as soon as I got into that concert, I got into the crowd, I got into that environment, and the music came on and the voice came out, there was joy there that I felt for the first time in a year and a half, where I felt fully in the moment, fully free. And I learned in that moment that it was possible to hold space for both joy and pain at the same time. And it was then that it clicked in my head how my mom got through all the stuff that she did. Because I've always said, I want to be as strong as my mom. I want to be a woman that has her kind of strength. And until I lost her, I didn't realize that her strength came from how much loss she experienced and the way she chose to move forward after those losses and say, like, this sucks, but how can I still make the best of my life? And after going to that concert, I was like, this is a way I can heal, because this gives me something to look forward to. This gives me something that makes me feel joyful. This is something that like reminds me of my childhood. It makes me feel like, you know, my childhood self again. And I started to be really purposeful about seeking joy in my life. And that became a life-changing mindset for me, where I understood that bad things are going to happen and we can't control them, but there's so much good in the world that we can control in our lives. Like, we can choose which good things to add to our lives. We can make a priority to look for those positive things. And so I started to do that. I just started to say, okay, what is good that I can look towards, that I can put my energy towards? And I volunteered to start coaching cheerleading, and that started to help me feel a little bit more like myself again, because I grew up cheerleading. I went to my 90s conventions. I went to my Backstreet Boys concerts. And little by little, I started to feel like me again. And at the same time, in between all of that, there was a lot of grief. It didn't make the grief go away, but it made it bearable, because when you're able to focus on what is good in the midst of what's going on that's bad, it makes the bad a little bit more bearable. It makes it easier to work through, because you know that's not the only thing that's going on.
What about the Backstreet Boys feels healing for you? Like, what about 90s music just grabs you and feeds your soul?
So it is the pure nostalgia of it. So I grew up as that kid with all of the posters on their wall. Like, I still have pictures on my walls now. But I was the kid whose room was wallpapered with Backstreet Boys. And it was my dream to like meet them. It was my dream to see them. Of course, you think you're going to fall in love with them one day and get married. But I was like teenage obsessed with the Backstreet Boys. And when they started to do things as an adult and I had some adult money, I was like, oh, wow, like I can actually do some things that make my teenage self's dreams come true. And as I that I just noticed that I felt most like myself in those environments where I felt like I could just be me. And honestly, I think it's because my teenage years were the last time that I stopped trying to shrink myself away in order to be who somebody else wants to be. After my teenage years, I got involved with the church and my first marriage and like all that stuff that was really, really toxic. And I go back now and I feel like the nostalgia of it when I'm looking at who is like the most authentic version of me and who am I before I started to shrink. And like, honestly, I'm still this boy band loving girl that like loves all her songs. They light me up. They like put a smile on my face in a way that I can't explain. And then it's cool to be able to do like meet and greet things and conventions and actually like do things that your childhood self could have never imagined that you would have been able to do. So for me, it became a lot of how do I make some of my childhood dreams come true? Like, how do I give that inner child the joy and excitement and everything that she needs? So I started to do, you know, all of these things, these 90s conventions where I'd meet, you know, all the people from the shows I grew up watching on TV, like Full House and Saved by the Bell and like all those kind of things. And putting myself in that moment, I just felt so free to be myself. There was nobody judging me. There was nobody scrutinizing the fact that, oh, this is what I love. Like, I'm in a community of people who love the same thing and are excited about the same thing and experiencing the same moment. Whereas at home, I would have to shrink myself away and pretend that I wasn't as excited and didn't love, you know, going to the shows as much as I did because my ex was threatened by that. And little by little, it was like I could be myself out at these shows. I could be at myself in these conventions. You know, I could be goofy and, you know, talk to celebs and like have a great time without somebody telling me like, why are you doing that? Why do you care about that? Like, he would beforehand, but at least I got to still go and enjoy all that stuff. And it's really where I discovered that, like, I just still have a love for 90s nostalgia. And I could probably come up with a bunch of different reasons on why that might be the fact. But the fact of the matter is that's what I love. And when you love something, who cares why? Like, if you're not hurting yourself or somebody else and you're doing something that you love, who cares what anybody else thinks about it? Who cares if anybody thinks that it's weird that you like to meet like your childhood, like idols and people that you grew up watching? Like, some people think it's weird, but me, it lights me up. I go to conventions and feel like I'm going to a high school reunion, except with people I want to see. And I go to Backstreet Boys concerts and I can just feel the energy in the room. It's like so unbelievably healing when you have all these people in the same place that are experiencing the same moment. There's just something powerful behind that.
Absolutely. I think, I mean, your mom passed away, which is really traumatic and horrifying and horrible, but at the same time, I feel like it gave you this strength to be yourself, to like dig deep into, okay, what makes me happy? And I feel like your mom would be so proud of you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Many people shrink themselves and continue to because they're like, oh, I can't do that because, you know, that's too childish or, you know, like, I don't know. People shrink themselves and they don't do those things because they feel like they have to be a certain way as they get older. Absolutely. Totally. So as you're healing and you're starting to feel this joy that you've never felt in so long, you started to realize the abuse that you were kind of tolerating in your marriage. And do you feel like finding yourself again finally gave you the courage to face that as well? Like your mom passed, you found joy, and now you're like, wait a minute, this isn't how I'm going to live my life.
Yeah, like the first year and a half after I lost my mom, I was terrified of losing my ex too. It was like I couldn't fathom the idea of losing another person in my life that I love. But the more I was able to go out and feel what it was like to be free, to be myself, the more I was like, I don't want to live this life that I'm living right now. Like even my dream of like being a mom, I kind of let that go because I realized that my ex was extremely toxic and reminded me of my dad. And I'm like, if I have children with this man, they're going to grow up feeling the way that I did. And that's the last thing that I want for a child in the world. Like it would be irresponsible to bring a child into this toxic situation. And so because of my age, I was like, if I'm not going to bring a child into a toxic situation, I'm not going to have kids and I'm going to have to be okay with that. And I remember thinking, if I don't have kids, what do I want to do with my life? What do I want my life to look like, you know? And the answer is pretty much a lot of what I'm doing now, going to concerts, going to conventions, traveling, like putting myself out there to try new things, chasing after childhood dreams a little bit, and like really, really, really began to discover Sam, but at the same time, like still dealing with my joy coming with consequences at home. So I could go out and I could have fun. And like, people don't realize like with abuse, it's not just like, they don't let you go out and have fun. You're never allowed to see your friends. Like a lot of times you do, you just pay for it afterwards. You pay for it in the emotional abuse that you get afterwards. And that was kind of what I was dealing with, where I was trying to live as authentically as I could as me. And at the same time, I've had a partner who was scrutinizing every part of her. And I was slowly realizing, I don't want to do this, but I didn't know, I hadn't reached my breaking point yet. And I reached my breaking point when we got into an argument one day, and I had said to him, because he was arguing about me going to a concert and about hearing, I was showing him a video and he heard me say, "Whoa, Joey," in the background. He just flipped out on me. He's like, "You screaming for another man? How dare you?" And I remember saying to him, "At this point, I feel like you're trying to push me away because it would be easier for you to lose me than to have to deal with all of the things that are at the root of what's causing this insecurity in you and causing you to treat me this way." And his response to me was, "Do you think that it would be easier for me to lose half of this house and half my paycheck and half my 401k? You wouldn't say nothing about how hard it would be to lose me." So that for me was like rose-colored glasses shattered. That moment is the moment I realized this man has no desire to change whatsoever. Like he is content in the misery that we are living in. And I know we'll get into this in a later episode, but that was like the beginning of the end for me because I saw what was going on and for the reality of it. I stopped living in the potential of the relationship and I faced what the reality was. And the reality was he didn't care that I was hurting. He didn't care if he was miserable. He didn't care if we kept fighting. I could keep going to my concerts and I would have to pay for it every time I came home and the, you know, emotional abuse and everything. But he was fine with it because as long as he could protect his ego and he could protect his money, that was all that mattered. And when those rose-colored glasses shattered, I remember I walked up into my office in my home and I heard my mom's voice in a way that I would have swore she was standing in the room with me. But I heard her voice clear as day say, "I raised you so much better than to let a man treat you this way." And I was like, "Wow, yeah, you definitely did." And then like 2 days later, I had a friend who had the same name as my mom. And I was saying, "I wish my mom were here because I wish she could tell me like what I should do. Like, how do I do this?" And she's like, "What would your mom tell you if she were here?" She would tell me to leave. Uh-huh. Like, she would tell me to leave. And that was the beginning of me making that decision to say, I need to find a way to choose myself. I need to find a way to move forward on my own because I was about to turn 40, and I was painfully aware that my mom passed at 56. So I was painfully aware that, like, my mom was 16 years older than me when she passed away. And there's always like this fear, like, oh, what if I die young, like my mom or anything? But I remember thinking, okay, if I were to only have 16 years, what would I want them to look like? Not this. Definitely. Like, I would want it to look like a life that I built on my own, a life that I love. And that's what I started to build. Slowly got myself out of the relationship. And I feel like my mom's strength has been there with me. And I know we'll talk in some later episodes about, you know, how, what it was like to actually get out of the relationship and what it was like to actually move to a new state and all of that. But in all of it, my mom, I always felt her presence with me. I always felt like she was there. I always felt like she was telling me, like, you've got this, you know, you can do this, you have the strength to do this. And I just constantly just tap into that and wanting to live my life in a way that my mom would be proud.
So Sammy, if your mom could see you today, you know, writing your book, helping other survivors, starting over, what do you think she'd say to you?
Oh my gosh, she would tell me that she's so proud of me. She would tell me that she's always known that I could, you know, do all this. She's always known that I'm so much stronger than I gave myself credit for. And she would tell me that she's so thankful that I'm able to live my life in a way that I'm having fun and that I'm enjoying. She'd say, she's like, don't give a crap about what anybody else thinks. Don't let anybody tell you that the way you're living your life is wrong. Like, what you're doing is making you happy. It's helping other people. Keep doing it. You know, she would be, I know she would be very, very proud.
Absolutely, she would. So Sammy, thank you so much for coming on the show today and for sharing such a vulnerable story. I would love for you to tell people more about the work that you're doing and where they can contact you if they're interested to speak with you.
Yeah, so yeah, the work I'm doing right now is I'm working with women who are dealing with a divorce or a breakup, whether that is trying to find a way to get out of the relationship or having just got out of it and needing to know, how do I start over? What do I do? How do I get to know myself? I really help take women from a place of being in survival mode to move into safety, to self-discovery, to self-trust, and to building a life that you absolutely love through my 12-week coaching program. You can reach me on LinkedIn under Samantha DeMarco. You can reach me on Instagram under SammyRose1010 or at Sammy Rose Coaching. And if you need to email me, you can also email me Sammy@SammyRose.com.
Amazing. Well, Sammy, thank you again for being here. I know we're going to dig deeper into your story in upcoming episodes. But again, I just think that the work that you're doing now is just so amazing and must be so fulfilling. And it's so awesome to hear your story. I mean, a lot of people are there struggling and they need someone like you in their corner to kind of like guide them through. You've been through it, you've done it. And now you're helping other women get through it too. And I just think that's amazing. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And it's true, because when you're going through something difficult, you need a solid support system.
Totally.
And it's okay to reach out to people that are not someone that is your friend. Sometimes having that outside support system with an outside perspective is so valuable in healing. I know it was for me. I had a team of people that helped me through getting out of my marriage and through my divorce, which we'll talk about more. But yeah, it's really powerful when you have somebody to walk through all of that with you.
Absolutely, 100%. Well, thanks again for being here. And I want to thank our audience also for tuning in. So today's conversation reminds us that grief doesn't simply end. It literally changes us. Sometimes it breaks our hearts, sometimes it opens our eyes, and sometimes through the pain, we slowly find a way back to ourselves. So Sammy's story is a reminder that healing doesn't always happen in one big moment. Sometimes it's found in memories, sometimes it's found in music, and sometimes it's found in choosing yourself one small step at a time. So if today's conversation resonated with you, keep an eye out for Sammy DeMarco's upcoming memoir, where she shares her journey in even greater depth, from trauma and loss to healing and hope. We'll also have her website and her social media linked in the show notes for you to have access to her and her stuff. And please follow us at The Advisor and send this episode to someone who you might think it would benefit from hearing it. Because we all go through grief, we all go through loss, and we all could use someone in our corner. Thanks again, everyone. Take care.